Hi, David Finkel. Welcome again to KABU.
Good morning.
David Finkel is the editor of the journal Against the Current. He's also a prolific writer, hundreds of pieces on the U.S. and international politics. He specializes in U.S. imperialist machinations in the Middle East, particularly in Israel-Palestine. And David is very critical of the current Zionist project and its U.S. partner. So, David, in the last month after Hamas's savage, murderous, and senseless attack, Israel has revealed itself as just as murderous and far more lethal, having killed over 16,000 people, about 6,000 children in aerial bombardments. That's in pursuit of its long-term goal to ethnically cleanse the entire territory that before 1948 was relatively peacefully inhabited by majority Palestinian and minority Jewish populations. In part one of this interview, played a couple weeks ago, we discussed the history of dispossession of Palestinian land and driving out Palestinians or enclosing them in smaller and smaller areas resembling those in apartheid South Africa. In this part two, we discuss settler colonialism. We explore its dynamic as the settlers seek to take control of the existing population, which, of course, triggers resistance from those indigenous. So the settlers take ever harsher measures to control them. And ever harsher measures are also used by the indigenous to defend their land and ways of life. That triggered the settlers to call them terrorists as the Hamas attack and Israeli punishment grow more murderous. That cycle doesn't end well. On that note, David, tell us about Hamas, its development, and Israel. It outsmarted itself just at the beginning of the vicious cycle.
Well, in the spirit of self-promotion, I have an article in our new issue of Against the Current. I've called it Catastrophe in Israel and Palestine, Apartheid on the Road to Genocide. And I do discuss some of the historical background. This article is on our website at againstthecurrent.org. Against the Current is just one word. Againstthecurrent.org, you'll find it there. Let me say I regard Hamas as a monster or a violent nemesis that Israel did a great deal to create. In 1982, I happened to be on a delegation of some left-wing journalists to the occupied territories in Israel. We visited Beer State University, which is the major Palestinian university of the West Bank, and the students told us about all the obstacles that they had, the closures, having to climb over barriers and stone walls to get to their campus. But they also told us something very important, which is that the Israeli occupation authorities were giving free passage to Islamic militants from Gaza, goons basically, to come and attack the students at Beer Zeit, who were nationalist students, the supporters of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And that shows how long ago Israel was already deliberately encouraging the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in Palestine. And Islamic fundamentalism is not particularly indigenous Palestinian Muslims, but it was funded by Egypt, of course. It was an Egyptian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, which crystallized into Hamas. And Israel viewed these forces as a way of breaking up the Palestinian national movement. In 2006, if we fast forward, there was actually a democratic election in Palestine, in the Palestinian occupied territories, for the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas won. Everyone was shocked by that, including Hamas. But it was understood by everybody that people didn't vote for Hamas because they liked its Islamic fundamentalist ideology or its attitudes about women or anything about that. It was a protest against the fact that Fatah, the leading force in what was the Palestinian Authority leadership in the West Bank, was hopelessly corrupt and impotent and incapable of resisting occupation or negotiating any kind of future or anything like that. So they actually, the two forces, Hamas and Fatah, understanding their respective weakness, took some initial steps towards forming a unity government. And at that point, as I cite in my piece, it was a big Vanity Fair expose on it, the United States and Israel tried to foment a coup to crush Hamas, because by that time, Fatah and what was left of the PLO were working with the Israeli occupation authorities to keep any popular resistance movement in check. The coup flopped, and Hamas wound up taking control of Gaza and purging supporters of Fatah, and Fatah took control in the West Bank and purged as much as they could the Islamist movement. So that was how Israel and the United States crushed the threat of Palestinian democracy. And Palestinian democracy was a threat to the occupation, because democracy can lead to popular mobilization, which is a threat that no armed struggle can possibly be. Israel can crush any armed struggle, even at the cost of enormous number of Palestinian lives, which they don't really care about. But a democratic popular mobilization is something that is much more difficult for them to handle. So that's the story of how Hamas wound up in control of Gaza. And then in recent years, Israel again has been allowing money from basically Qatar, more than any other country, into repair Gaza after the repeated rounds of Israeli bombings and so forth, which they call mowing the grass. Now, there is a book, if you want to read about Gaza, there is a book called Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom by Norman Finkelstein. It came out in 2018, but it's still very relevant. The other person you can look up to read about Gaza, really probably the leading economic expert on the area, is Sarah Roy. That's S-A-R-A, and her last name is Roy, R-O-Y, and you can look up her work. But Gaza has been basically strangled. Israel occupied it with settlers in 2005 and then withdrew and subjected Gaza to a brutal siege, which was even worse than the direct occupation. And that's what led to the current explosion.
Through the whole period, you read the prediction by the group of left critics of Israel in 1967 and Israel's mounting efforts to control the West Bank and every place else, and how that leads to resistance, and the resistance then leads to further attacks and jailings and murders. And the beat goes on, and we're seeing the fruits of it. My sense is that for a quite long period, we're seeing the realization of what the Jewish left predicted in 1967, that is, of the vicious circle in the West Bank and Gaza, making life a mounting misery for the unfortunate residents. Tell us a little bit about the difficulties of life under occupation in the West Bank and Israeli administration of the Gazan economy and water and all the rest of it, that they're now, in fact, trying to starve the remaining Gaza residents. Now have no oil, little water coming in, and food is very, very scarce. There's going to be deaths from hunger or lack of water included in the mounting deaths from attack from the air. Give us a sense of how that vicious cycle works.
Well, it is a vicious cycle, which is built into the dynamic of the siege of Gaza. But I believe the current situation is actually driven by something, the current Israeli war is driven by something much more squalid and sordid, and that is Netanyahu's attempt to save his governing coalition, because he needs political power to save himself from prosecution and prison on corruption charges, which may be something that sounds vaguely familiar. But he's totally unpopular and despised in Israel for a number of reasons. His attempt to seize control of the judiciary and the total lack of preparation for the October 7th attack, because military units had been moved from the south of Israel into the West Bank, where they are protecting West Bank settlers who are waging pogroms and massacres and riots against Palestinian villages. So Netanyahu needs this war to preserve his governing coalition. His governing coalition includes ministers from two explicitly ethnic cleansing genocidal parties, one called Jewish Power and the other Religious Zionism. And there are ministers in the government with powerful positions in internal security. Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich are their names. Keeping that coalition together requires an essentially genocidal policy, because coalition and therefore Netanyahu's grip on power are held hostage by these extreme racist genocidists. There's no other word for it. So therefore, in order to preserve his coalition, and especially in view of the shocking, traumatizing murder of over 1,000 Israelis on October 7th, the war, Israel's war in Gaza, is literally genocidal. Genocide is not a word I use for purposes of, you know, analogy or something like that. I think it means the planned destruction of a people, and this is the nature of Israel's war. So I say, driven partly by a certain kind of ethnic cleansing logic that has been always there in the Zionist movement, but I think is propelled right now by the state of Israeli politics, and also the guarantee of support it gets from wide segments of the American political system, particularly the evangelical Christians who see this all as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy.
This is Bill Resnick talking to David Finkel, the editor of the magazine Against the Current. He's written hundreds of articles on the Middle East, especially the Israeli-Palestinian struggle. We've been discussing the vicious cycle of oppressor and oppressed. Also, it's a vicious escalation, and how it's been driven by the ethnic cleansing of Zionism and the desperate acts of Israel's premier Netanyahu to retain power. David, it seems to me that for some time the Zionists have had sympathy for most of the world, sympathy as the victims of the Nazis, their gas chambers, the Holocaust, and the search for the people who went to Israel, sometimes because it was their only place in the world that would accept them, their search for safety and security. But now creating this vicious cycle and ethnic cleansing on the way to the genocide, they've become the oppressor. I wonder, David, could that eventuate in international pressure for a two-state solution or maybe a binational state?
Well, the short answer as far as a binational solution is that the Hamas attack of October 7th and the war that Israel is now waging have actually set back any such possibility for a very long time. I mean, that's just the reality. Hamas's murderous attack of October 7th created a wave of sympathy for Israel in many parts of the world, and then within a week, Israel's siege and war in Gaza had turned that to revulsion. There is widespread revulsion in the world, and particularly in the Arab and Middle Eastern countries, to what Israel is doing. Does that put pressure on Israel? Well, it puts pressure on some of those governments, in particular what has been the centerpiece of American policy, which is to broker the normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia and then the other Gulf states, UAE, Qatar, etc. The U.S. plan has been that you create normalization between Israel and the Arab regimes, and then Palestine fades into irrelevance, and whatever happens to it doesn't have to really concern American policy very much. That, of course, has now been blown up. But pressure on Israel, meaningful pressure on Israel, can only come from one place, and that's the American government. And while you see the U.S. government pleading with Israel for a humanitarian pause, so-called, which means nothing, the U.S. government refuses, despite growing international pressure and despite growing domestic pressure, as you see from all of these huge demonstrations that are going on, the United States government refuses to call for a ceasefire. So in that respect, there isn't meaningful pressure on Israel. Now, among the populations of many countries, there's enormous sympathy for the Palestinians. And I would say, actually, my guess is that there is one country in the Middle East where there is popular sympathy for Israel, and that would be Iran, because the Iranian government is at war, of course, with its own population, and therefore Iran's blood-curdling but basically meaningless anti-Israel rhetoric will make many Iranians sympathetic to Israel. But other than that, yes, there is popular revulsion against Israel around the world, which is going to produce various blowbacks, including it's partly responsible for the rise in anti-Semitism in many places, as people identify the Israeli state with the Jewish people, as false as that equation is. But pressure on Israel for a binational solution, not in our lifetime, barring some miracle.
David, let's shift to discuss a force that will likely shape the future across the world. That is climate change, which is going to make life unlivable across the Middle East, among many other areas.
That is entirely true. When you look 50 years out, how much of the area is going to be habitable? How much of the U.S. South and Southwest is going to be habitable? That should be the lead story in the news every day in every part of the world, okay? But part of the current tragedy, of course, is that those issues which really threaten in an existential way the future of human civilization everywhere are buried.
Yeah, my sense is, I think I may steal the last word, that it's quite possible that if a series of climate catastrophes will wake up the popular classes all over the world to understand that the elites of the world have led them to a place where their lives and the lives of their children are threatened, and threatened deeply. And they may, there may be movements, if they really get big and unstoppable, would be for working class movements to gain popular support for directing the mobilization of all resources to stop climate change. We have to be lucky that, in fact, it's possible to stop it after concentrations get so high. That would then lead to, what it seems to me, an international agreements that would change the position of all countries and lead to something approaching a democratic socialist solution. Anyway, it's amazing that we can talk about these things and not be seen as nuts. But there you have it. Dave, you get the last word. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Phil.
Okay, well, thanks very much. And I guess my appeal would be, wherever you are, whatever you can do, get into the streets to demand an immediate ceasefire. That doesn't address fundamental problems, which we can't solve on our own. But it is essential to raise the temperature to demand an immediate ceasefire, because there are already over 10,000 deaths, and in the next week, it'll be 20,000. So it is absolutely essential to foreground that demand right now, right here. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for talking to us today, Dave. We've run out of time.
Okay.
That's all, folks. David Finkel and I, we've conversed on the history of Israel taking over lands previously inhabited by Palestinians, and the development of a vicious cycle of dispossession and repression, then resistance, with Hamas's recent senseless and savage attack, and the even more savage Israeli response with bombardment from the air, killing near 20,000 Palestinians and apparently not stopping, and over 6,000 children. We need now work in this country on which Israel depends for this country to join with nearly all the rest of the world to demand Israel that it agree to a ceasefire and start of international negotiations that would ultimately maneuver for a peaceful solution that Israel might not like very much, but have to be get the consolation of creating a relatively peaceful Middle East. Thanks for talking to us today, Dave.
Okay, thanks.
Time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Custom. sacred nation is ready for a fight. Custer, I think it's gonna